The Lara Murphy Show, Episode 3.
Welcome to The Lara Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everybody. We are here. It is now episode 3 of the Lara Murphy Show. I'm your host, Bob Murphy, or I'm one of your hosts, Bob Murphy. And as always, with me is Carlos Lara. Carlos, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Bob.
Now, for this episode, I want to give the listeners some more background information to see, because this is one area where I was just really happy, and I knew I had sort of hitched my horse to the right wagon, or whatever the metaphor would be here. I grew up in the suburbs, folks. I really don't know anything about horses or wagons for that matter. But Carlos and I had been writing the Lara Murphy Report, and you can see sample issues of this at our website, of course, laramurphy.com. And that is with a hyphen, lara-murphy.com, lara-murphy.com. And you can see the Lara Murphy Report there. And it was back in, I believe, Carlos, was it May of 2014, you had an article called Bank Deposits Are Risky Now More Than Ever. And this is available for people to see it for free at the website. If you just go searching and find the LMR Greatest Hits, you can see it. And what was interesting about that is I remember, Carlos, you were doing research for your article, because I was banging out stuff at the time about Austrian economics, who knows what. And you were doing research for your article in the LMR, and you were looking up the Dodd-Frank Act, and you were literally reading the actual statutory language. Like, this is lawyer language, and you were going through that. And I was thinking, what are you doing that for? Nobody reads the things. Even the people voting on it don't bother reading it. And yet you did, and you found some amazing things in there far before, like, Zero Hedge and these other sites were running off with this stuff. You knew about it, and that's why you wrote it up in the Lara Murphy Report. So why don't you just summarize for our listeners exactly what happened and what you found?
Okay, well, yes, that's correct. I actually did read that document. I can understand why a lot of people still don't know much about it, because, my goodness, that thing is over 1,000 pages long. And it's full of legalese, and unless you understand bankruptcy law, which I do simply because of the nature of the work that I'm involved in, if you understand bankruptcy law and you try to read the document, it all of a sudden becomes pretty entertaining material. But at the same time, you can get, pretty upset and shocked over some of the things that you are reading. And so this is a law that was enacted in January 2010. I think President Obama signed it into law that July. And this is a law that is called Dodd-Frank, for short, but it really is a complete overhaul of the financial markets, I guess, since the Great Depression. It came on the heels of the 2008 financial crisis. And I guess, once Americans started settling in with the idea that all of these bailouts that took place during that period of time really wound up hitting the taxpayer very hard. Congress obviously stepped in to try to find out how all this had come about and to put in new regulations in place, which is typically what they do when some disaster happens. This makes me think of Robert. Is it Robert Higgs who calls it the ratchet effect? Is that right, Bob? The ratchet effect?
Yeah, right, yeah. So for our listeners who don't know, Robert Higgs, or he often goes just by Bob Higgs, but he was an economist who does a lot in terms of economic history. Crisis and Leviathan is his baby. And he has this thesis called, as Carl says, the ratchet effect, which says that, when you want to understand how is it that government just grows over time, what happens is there'll be a crisis. The government will go way up in terms of its power and the money it takes forth and so on. And then after the crisis recedes, the government will give back some of those powers. It'll shrink, but it doesn't go back to the pre-crisis level. And so that's what he means by a ratchet effect, that if you look at the size of government by some metric over time, it ratchets up, comes back, ratchets it up, comes back. And that's why there's a secular trend toward bigger and bigger government.
Yeah, and that's what this reminds me of when I read this law. You know, we had this major crisis in 2008. A lot of folks were hurt. And Congress is stepping in now and trying to correct the situation. It's putting in all these new rules and regulations. And what you start to see when you read the law is that obviously they're trying to bolster confidence back into the markets when the crisis occurred. You know, investors ran away from the market. So the law supposedly is supposed to be an investor protection act. It's a way to create transparency on Wall Street. These are some of the reasons for the enactment of the law. But in addition to this, they are also granting extended powers to the Federal Reserve, to the SEC, and to the FDIC. And what they are trying to address here is the matter of systemic risk. And so just to make sure we understand what we mean by systemic risk, it's a situation that you see occur every time you have bank depositors, make a run on the bank. The bank is obviously immediately thrown into insolvency simply because they don't have the money in the vaults to give all of the depositors. And so this is when we realize that bank is insolvent, needs to close immediately. And but rather than stopping with that one bank, it creates sort of a domino effect, and other banks begin to fall. You know, people are panicked now. They're rushing into banks. And as we saw in the 2008 crisis, I think we had over 1,200 banks that were underwater because we had so many runs on banks.
If I could stop you just for a second, Carlos, again, I know we got a lot of new listeners here who may not be familiar with some of these concepts. The fundamental reason for why commercial banking, as it is practiced in the modern world, is so vulnerable to these things. I mean, because if you think about it, it's not like, well, gee, what if a bunch of people all of a sudden, you know, wanted to go get Slurpees? Would that make the whole, you know, Slurpee empire crumble or something? You know, that doesn't make any sense, right? Why is it that what is it about banking per se that makes it so vulnerable to these waves of pessimism and so on? It's not because of banking per se. It's because of what's called fractional reserve banking. The fact that when you put $1,000 in cash in your checking account, they don't keep that in a vault with your name on it. They lend out most of that to other people under normal circumstances. And that's why if everybody shows up to take out his or her money from what they think is in their own checking accounts, the bankers say, sorry, we don't have it. And you get that situation. So we talk about that extensively in our book, How Privatized Banking Really Works. I definitely encourage people to go look at that. I think in terms of the average person who's not trained in economics, putting all modesty aside, if you really want to understand fractional reserve banking, that book, How Privatized Banking Really Works, explains it in the most straightforward manner. Okay, well, I'll give you back the microphone, Carlos, to return to the narrative about Dodd-Frank and what does this have to do with systemic risk?
Okay, so the law is addressing that particular problem, and the law now affects all major financial institutions with over $50 billion in assets now falls under the auspices of the Dodd-Frank Act. But Of course, the real culprits in this systemic risk are not all financial institutions. It's mostly commercial banks because of what Robert just mentioned, this fractional reserve banking situation, which when people make a run on the bank is going to fail. So the Dodd-Frank Act is putting in place some rules that is saying to financial institutions, you've got to make every effort now to bolster up your balance sheets in order to deal with this, these problems of systemic risk. There's a lot of talk in there about what they refer to as the use of contingent capital as a way to bolster up balance sheets. Now, contingent capital is a hybrid security. It's a debt instrument. It allows these financial institutions to raise capital for themselves, but in a debt security fashion. However, if a crisis occurs, once certain thresholds are reached, these securities flip into equity. So they no longer remain a debt instrument. It immediately flips over to an equity, and that, of course, gives the financial institution instant liquidity, which is the purpose of the contingent capital. Now,
let me just stop you there for a second, Carlos, because you're using some accounting terminology that, again, our listeners might not understand. So, just forget banking for a second. Just a regular corporation, if they want to go build a factory and they can't do it out of cash flow, so they need money from outsiders. They need $1 million from outsiders to bring into the enterprise so they can go and build this new factory. So there's two ways they can do it. They can either issue debt, meaning the corporation auctions off bonds, and then, you know, outside lenders give them the money and they can raise $1 million that way by issuing more debt, or they can sell more shares of the corporation. So more people in the community will own stock in the corporation and they can raise another $1 million that way. So issuing the bonds is called issuing debt. The stock is called issuing more equity. And the nature of the ownership claims, though, so there's both different ways that outsiders now have a claim on that enterprise or that corporation, but the debt holders, they get paid first, right? There, what they have is like a bond saying the holder of this note gets $1,000 next January, and then, you know, they paid 900 and something for that. Whereas the shareholders, the people who own the stock, all they get to do is divvy up the profits, the net income of the firm, if it is profitable. So they're not being promised any specific dollar payment. They're just going to get a share of what's left, assuming the enterprise is profitable. So what Carlos is saying is this contingent capital, the contingent mean, you know, there's contingencies. That means, but depending on different scenarios, one thing could happen or the other. If you have a contingency plan, that means what happens if things go bad? What do we do then? That's what it means to have a contingency plan. So he's saying people can have what they thought was a debt claim, saying we are owed this money, period. But if things go really bad, all of a sudden, oh, no, actually, it's not a debt claim. It's equity. Okay. Is that, you agree with what I just said?
No, that's absolutely.
That's good. It's always awkward when one host contradicts the other. Okay. So now returning it back to
now,
you.
Now, in addition to that, it may even call for that contingent capital to get a haircut up to 100% under certain thresholds. So now the thing about these instruments is that they're nothing new and they're actually pretty good instruments to use. The insurance sector has used contingency capital for a very long time. But these are one of the things that the Dodd-Frank Act specifically points to as a way to bolster up the balance sheets of financial institutions. And they've established, I don't know, almost 267 rules altogether that these financial institutions now have to abide by. And as I said, it covers all financial institutions and non-bank financial institutions with assets over $50 billion. So it's a pretty stringent law. But the thing that really is troublesome in one way and in another way, perhaps it's a good thing. The law is stating very clearly that if we have a crisis, anything like what we had in 2008, there will not be any bailouts. In other words, the taxpayer is not going to be asked to bail out these too big to fail financial institutions. So, as I said, in one sense, well, that's a good thing. I guess when you think it through, if we had a crisis of the magnitude that we have in 2008, and we're all expecting it's even going to be worse, if all of a sudden we learn that these too big to fail financial institutions were going to be bailed out again, I really think that there would be an outcry in the streets, or there'd be riots in the street, probably. Because even though we as taxpayers didn't really get the significance of what was going on in the beginning, you know, with all this bailout that was going to these financial institutions, after a while, we begin to realize that the taxpayer really did get hammered. And then we saw, of course, these big banks, you know, giving big bonuses. And of course, what we see today is they're more profitable than ever.
Okay, let me just make sure everyone's getting the significance there. So what you're claiming, and I agree with you, is that in the fall of 2008, everyone remembers the timeline here, that's when the crisis really struck, when Lehman went down, the Fed came in and took over AIG, and then you had Henry Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary, former head of Goldman Sachs, by the way, just a coincidence. He was going around like it was ridiculous. He was, if you remember, Carlos, he was literally, I think, got down on one knee and was begging Nancy Pelosi, saying we need to get funds to bail out the financial sector because all these major Wall Street firms were in serious trouble. And so, yes, so this was distinct from what the Federal Reserve was doing. The federal government had the so-called TARP program, Trouble Asset Relief Program, and they came in and basically made an offer that the bankers couldn't refuse and took ownership claims in all the major banks. And so that's what people meant by saying the bailout. And so as Carlos is saying, that ultimately what's happening there is the taxpayers were on the hook, right? Because if the federal government does something, ultimately that means the taxpayers are doing that. And so the taxpayers were the ones who rescued all of these big firms that had made a lot of very poor decisions during the housing bubble years. And so now Carlos is saying, under Dodd-Frank, they were laying a completely different regulatory infrastructure such that if and when another crisis hits and we have a bunch of major financial institutions that are insolvent, that the way they're going to do, they're not going to come in and just have the taxpayer inject money to make them all whole again the way they did last time. Instead, they're not going to do a bailout. What are they going to do?
Well, they're referring to it as statutory bail-in. Now, to explain the bail-in and the significance of the bail-in, the first thing I need to say about it is that obviously when a corporation gets into financial trouble, it typically, you know, files for protection under bankruptcy, they file for a Chapter 11. So when I talk about that the Dodd-Frank Act has given extended powers to the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, and the SEC, it's almost as though they're going to skip that process altogether and that they are going to become judge and jury on a financial institution on the spot. And they are, rather than using a bailout to bail out the financial institution that's become insolvent, in order to nip the problem in the bud, they're actually going to begin a bail-in by taking the capital of that financial institution, which is going to be the money that belongs to the stockholders of that particular financial institution, and all of its creditors. Now, the significance of those two parties, the stockholders and the creditors, I need to at this point remind the listeners that the creditors of that financial institution are...
Well, hang on, Carl. I think I know where you're going. Let me stop you. Let's do it in a more general context before we apply it to banking.
Okay.
So, for example, you have history in the retail sector with firms that get into trouble. So there, who are the stockholders and creditors, and how does that relate to debt versus equity?
Well, once again, you will have secured creditors and unsecured creditors in any kind of bankruptcy situation, a Chapter 11 situation in bankruptcy. You know, typically speaking, the secured creditor are those creditors that actually have some sort of security on the assets of the company. So in going into bankruptcy courtrooms, a lot of times when you're dealing with businesses, typically the secured creditor is a bank because they wind up taking liens on all of the assets of a business. Usually the unsecured creditors are all those creditors that have been shipping products or goods into the company. And they actually do it on an unsecured basis because they're extending open credit. And when they ship their product into the warehouse of the of these companies, the minute the product hits the docks and enters into the warehouse, those suppliers, the title to those goods changes hands, and now it becomes the products of the company. They own them, even though they may not have paid the suppliers for it yet.
Okay, so is this a fair summary? You've got some retail outlet. It's like somebody owns a clothing store that's in a strip mall, and they borrowed money from a bank maybe to buy the property. Let's say they have a mortgage, and the bank has liens on everything. And then also some company that makes jeans ships them a bunch of jeans, and they have those in inventory. And so both the jean ship company, the manufacturer, and the commercial bank there are creditors. So they both have debt interests in the company, right? So if the company does really well, it's not like it has to share the profits with them. It just has to pay what it owes contractually, whereas the stockholders of that retail outlet would be or they might just be the owners. And so the priority is that the stockholders get hit first, and then if there's still not enough, then obviously I'm assuming the bankruptcy court, it goes to the secured creditors, and then the unsecured get whatever scraps are possibly left over?
That is correct. That's correct. Now, the analogy I'm trying to draw there, and I think it's sort of a scary analogy, and that's what led to the title of my article, is that bank deposits are now all of a sudden become very risky because of the Dodd-Frank Act, now more than ever. And it's because I'm saying that when we as depositors into a bank, whether it's a business or an individual, we all do the same thing. We deposit either our paychecks from where we work or the revenue from our businesses goes into commercial banks. Everybody does this. We drive up to the drive-through window maybe once a day, twice a day, three times a day, depending for your business, or you may go there once a week when you get paid or bi-monthly, whatever it is, we all do it. We take that plastic container, we deposit our checks and our revenue into that plastic container, and we send it down that tube. And we all do it. You know, we hear that swishing sound going in. Well, the thing to keep in mind is that when the teller receives that deposit, the title to our money changes hands. In other words, we had possession of the money, but once the bank gets a hold of it, it now belongs to the bank. Now, the bank does owe it to us as depositors, but once they have it, it is their money and really to do with it whatever they want to do. But it's the changing of title that's very important here. because, as I said, with the Dodd-Frank Act and there not being any more bailouts, but instead bail-ins, we have a situation where the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, the SEC are all going to come in with orders, legal orders, to resuscitate that financial institution using the capital of the stockholders and all of the creditors of that financial institution. Now, if it's a bank that has failed, those creditors are the depositors. And so depositors will not be able to get their money out. They're going to use that money to try to resuscitate that business. That's the key, and that's the main thing of the Dodd-Frank Act that does create, you know, some problems for all of us now as depositors into banks specifically.
Let me just stop you there to make sure everyone's getting that. So just as folks, if you understood the analogy where the company that makes jeans, that manufactures jeans and then ships them to a retail outlet that, you know, has a storefront in a strip mall or something, how legally speaking, if they're unsecured creditors, once that store takes possession of the jeans, they're the owners. And then that, if it comes in down to bankruptcy, the manufacturer who shipped them to them, they got to just sit there and maybe they'll get pennies on the dollar in the settlement. By the same token, Carlos is saying when you deposit your money in a commercial bank, you go and you get a paycheck from your employer, you deposit it and your checking account balance goes up by that, you know, $2,500 or whatever, and say, "Woo, all right, I got that money. That's my money. The bank owes it to me." You're a creditor of the bank. The bank has a debt to you now legally and in terms of the accounting, but you're an unsecured creditor. And so if that bank gets into trouble, according to the way that the Dodd-Frank Act specifies how it will be unwound and so forth, you know, you may only get pennies on the dollar compared to what you thought you had in there.
That's correct. And of course, the Dodd-Frank Act actually mirrors the Basel III Accord, which, you know, covers the whole Eurozone, Europe. And we actually have seen some test cases of this bail-in structure. In particular, we saw it in Cyprus. And if we can just think for a minute what happened in Cyprus back in 2013, the citizens of Cyprus woke up one weekend morning, you know, prepared to do their normal shopping and dining out like the rest of us. They go to their ATM machines and they can't get their money out. The money was frozen. And so they panic. So they go to the branch. There they see a big crowd in front of the bank, and there's a big sign on the door of the bank that says that the bank is closed indefinitely. And what we found out as we were paying attention to what was going on during that period of time is that bank stayed closed for 12 days as they tried to figure out how they were going to resuscitate that business. And now, I don't know about you, but it would be very difficult for me and probably most businesses not to be able to access their cash for 12 days. But that's exactly what happened in Cyprus. And so, yes, a lot of businesses failed because they were not able to get access to their cash. Now, when the banks reopened again, the depositors, some of them got paid. But most of the depositors and all of the stockholders basically got equity in a defunct bank. So instead of getting their money back, they got a piece of paper, which was stock in this company that was, for all practical purposes, defunct. Now, it's hard to make payroll or do anything with a piece of paper in which it's just a promise that you're going to get paid down the road. So these were the ramifications of that particular bail-in. Now, the incredible thing about it is that the officials and the government all thought it was a very successful plan because they didn't have to use taxpayer money. There was no bailout involved. But on the other hand, those particular depositors and those particular stockholders that were trapped and caught in that situation, they lost most of their money. And that's probably the most troublesome thing of what I see now in the Dodd-Frank Act. And it's especially troublesome now as we see the signs of the of even a bigger crisis looming ahead. And so, as you know, Bob, we've been sort of advising our folks and anyone that will listen to us that it's, you know, they should not keep too much money in commercial banks, in large part because we now have this law in place. It's been there since 2010. And the worrisome part about it from me and my perspective is that I start thinking about what caused the last financial crisis. And we all know it's coming. We're starting to see the signs. More than likely, it's going to start in the derivatives market because that's where the last one started. If you'll remember, Bob, that's when the money market funds got hit first. And it really ignited the whole thing. And what we're seeing right now is that the derivatives market is flying high again. In fact, the Bank of International Settlements is putting out numbers that the total amount or the notional value of the worldwide derivatives market right now stands at $700 trillion. At the same time, it's putting out numbers that the GDP of the whole world is $75 trillion. And I know these are very vague concepts, but just the disparity between these two numbers, you know, tells us that there's just not enough money in the world to cover these risky bets. The United States alone, I think, is nearing $300 trillion all by itself in the derivatives market. So it's not a good sign to see this type of situation in light of the Dodd-Frank Act. Now, I know there's a lot of us out there think, well, you know, I've got the FDIC to protect me. You know, I've got coverage up to $250,000. And if I reach my max at that particular bank, I move across the street and I just deposit over there. But we have to remember that all commercial banks are part of the Federal Reserve System. And because of their systemic risk problem, you know, having it across the street is not necessarily, you know, safety. The FDIC was very busy in 2008 when we saw 1,200 banks go underwater. It was very busy trying to pay back depositor money, but it did run out of money. I think it went in the hole close to $9 billion. And so it did have to go back to the Treasury to borrow just to shore up their fund. I think the current amount in the fund at this point, I haven't checked it recently, but it was about $45 billion, which sounds like a nice cushion there to deal with depositor money. But when you compare it to the total amount of U.S. bank deposits, and you realize that that total is $10.1 trillion. Well, my goodness, you know, the FDIC can only cover maybe 0.25% of all U.S. deposits, bank deposits. So these are sort of the signs that are there, the facts that are there, and in lieu of the Dodd-Frank Act and these extended powers, and you put it all together, and for us, it simply means keep very little money in commercial banks. very little. Any other excess money ought to be, you know, swept into something much more conservative and away from the Dodd-Frank Act, if at all possible.
Okay, Carlos, let me stop you there, partly because we're over time for we want to try to limit these episodes, keep them in manageable chunks, and also because you're, I think you're probably just depressing everybody. Let me just summarize everything Carlos said there very quickly. The point is, people acknowledge that, oh yeah, interest rates have been horrible lately. You put your money in the bank, it's not going to earn anything, but hey, at least it's safe, right? Because the government guarantees it. And so as Carlos is saying that, no, actually the way the Dodd-Frank Act has restructured everything, they're getting ready. The people in power are getting ready to have so-called bail-ins. And we saw, this isn't just a theoretical worry. We saw what happened in Cyprus. Just to clarify, I went and Googled to get the final figures here. My understanding is once the dust settled, what happened was for people, for depositors and the two biggest banks over there who had 100,000 euro or more, they got a haircut of it. I think it was 47.5%. All right. So in other words, so the little people were okay because they thought politically we're not going to hurt them. But anybody who had more than 100,000 euros in there, in their accounts, they just got almost half of it wiped out because that was their share of what happened. And as Carlos said, you know, we're not saying the government ought to come in and rescue those banks. I mean, it's good if there's an institution that is in trouble that they don't think that therefore the government should come in and rescue them, but don't for a minute think that because we have the FDIC, that means everything is nice and rosy, because that's not the case at all. Okay, well, with that, we will end this, the third episode of the Laura Murphy Show. I want to remind people that if you're interested in these ideas, go to the website, lauramurphy.com. That's LARA-Murphy.com, and just explore. We have a lot of these issues up, in particular the May 2014 article, Bank Deposits Are Risky Now More Than Ever, in which Carlos first laid out all of this research that he had done on the Dodd-Frank Act. To us now, these notions of bailing and so on are considered old hat, but I remember that Carlos broke this particular aspect of the story there before I had seen it being reported in Zero Hedge and so forth months later. Well, everyone, thank you for tuning in, and remember to tell your friends about the Laura Murphy Show. Thanks for listening.
You've just finished another episode of the Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.